150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. I'm gonna shine my way. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And they're into the stretch. Oh, my goodness.
This is the place to be.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
All right, welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Croucher here with Drew Dinsick. We're going to talk all NBA today, takeaways from the weekend. We'll go through really each of the series, but particularly the ones that have games tonight, Monday night when you're listening. But Drew, how was your weekend?
It was incredible. Shout out to New Zealand's own, Auckland, New Zealand's own Scott Dixon for coming through in the Long Beach Grand Prix. Really, sure. This was like if there's no bad weekend to be living in Southern California, but one of the best weekends to be living here is the weekend of the Grand Prix. It's just the weather is perfect, and people that came into town, we had just a great, great time with some of our gambling mutual friends. It was a really, really fun weekend all around, and the fact that the NBA has generally broken my way has made it more enjoyable. Outside of the Lakers sticking their finger in my eye again, the results pretty much went my way. The Clippers Mavericks is probably the most interesting series at this point, considering what the Mavericks did today. Ultimately, I think the major takeaway so far is, it's good to be homey. It's good to be at home, Jay. Since the Lakers beat the Pelicans, it has been a whitewashing to this point in the playoffs of home teams, not just winning, but covering and covering in style. We have basically every single home team. You know, we have not seen the result of Thunder Pelicans, obviously, but we are the homies are running right now, as they say.
Yes, they are. Been able to watch a fair bit of NBA this weekend, though on Friday night, Drew, my wife came up to me out of the blue and she said, I'd like to go away for the weekend by myself, want to have a break from the kids. I was like, well, it's first weekend of the NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs, million positions in all these European soccer leagues coming down to the wire, but that's fine. I'll take the 6'3" and 1-year-old all by myself for 2 days, but it actually worked out okay. They were much better behaved than anticipated. I'd say they were like on 95th percentile behavior. So I was able to watch a fair bit of basketball that was mostly on the second screen, to be fair. With Paw Patrol and Bluey.
You know what they call this, right? You know what they say. You're running good, Jay.
Yes, I'm running good. Results relatively favorable as well, and we'll get into that. I don't think we need to talk a great deal for now about the Milwaukee Bucks, who, as we speak, are absolutely rolling the Indiana Pacers. I just think that's a really difficult series to even talk about, just because is Giannis coming back game two? Probably not. Is he coming back game three, game four? I'd probably set the over-under at game 3.5, but that's just purely guesswork. So with that one, I think we'll talk a bit more about that as we have more clarity on the health statuses there, but disgraceful showing from the Pacers. And we'll talk about this with Mavs Clippers as well, but a lot of the problem with just like losing game one when the opposing star is out, like one, it's obviously very bad to just go down 1-0 in a best of seven series, but it just means you give the other team time. You give them time. You've given Giannis and Kawhi time to get back, which is maybe the worst thing of all. But let's go to New York, which personally for me is my highest leverage series, having bet fairly heavily on the New York Knickerbockers when they were open dogs in the series, and then more at -105, more at -110, and so on. And I got to say, Drew, 15 minutes into game one, It was the Arrested Development thing.
I've made a huge mistake.
Joel Embiid looks absolutely incredible. But then he got hurt. But what did you make of that game?
Well, it's funny that I was going to make the "I have made a huge mistake" joke before you even referenced Arrested Development. So we're on the same page there. But yes, as a heavy Knicks man, first of all, yes, quarter one and quarter three were terrifying. Like, what in the world? Were it not for Josh Hart finding the absolute perfect time to hit the best shots of the season for the Knicks, that could have gone sideways. And I think now I'm excited to just, okay, this is now Knicks series as far as I can tell you, because the quick turnaround and the likelihood that the injury that Joel Embiid had in that game has some impact on his performance in game two, I think, is high. And so, like, you know, if the tables are turned, and then in Sixers are not up heading into the fourth quarter, is there some kind of plausible reason for the coaching staff to just throw up the white flag and say, hey, like, we just got to go defend home court. Like, this game's unwinnable. Joel needs some time. The fact that the beginning of this series is compressed from a time standpoint, I think all of this is very favorable for the Knicks. So I think the fact that they got that done, and in particular, not in particular the way they did it, but just the fact that they were able to persevere, makes me feel very, very positive about them ultimately getting this series done before we get to game six, which I know maybe sounds aggressive, but I don't currently feel like 100% Embiid for the rest of the series is a likelihood. It's too late. He's the fitness is not gonna just materialize, and I think the likelihood of re-injury is very high.
Yeah, I think this is the most fascinating round one series, and maybe it's because it's the one I got the most money on, but to me it's fascinating from a pricing perspective, because one, the Knicks open the series +115 dogs to win the series, despite opening as 3-point favorites in game one.
That was a bad
with home court throughout the series. Now, by the time the series tipped off, the Knicks were -145 to win the series, despite nothing changing in terms of health news. So I just don't really understand the market mechanic there. It's not like sometimes you get a bad opener and it corrects, like Boston, Brooklyn, famously with the Celtics opening dog and then closing favorites and then sweeping Brooklyn. Yeah. This one was -110 for days and then just closed -145. And I think what makes it most fascinating is that, like, it really becomes an exercise in how you price the probabilities that Joel Embiid is going to be healthy at, like, different levels of health. Like, all right, what's the series price if Embiid is 100% from game two the rest of the series? What's the series price if he's, I would say he's like the guy that he was against Miami in the play-in game, in the second half of game one against New York? That to me looks like 65-70% of Joel Embiid. So if you're saying that 100% healthy Embiid is like a +8, and then the guy that he was in this kind of limited state is like a +4.5, +5 maybe, I don't know. And then, like, what are the probabilities that, you know, we get fully healthy Embiid, which seems extremely low. What's the probability that he lasts through the series? Like, what price is it that he finishes the series healthy? Because he's re-injured himself 3 times now, and each time he comes back into the game looking worse, but he always comes back. So I'm just not really sure how to price that aspect. And then you've also got the Knicks, who I thought their process in game one was horrific. And they got bailed out because Josh Hart and McBride just made, I think Hart and McBride were 9 of 15 from 3, and they needed all of them, because if they didn't get them, and these are like circus shots as well that Josh Hart in particular was making. Brunson, I don't know what happened to Brunson. Brunson just didn't seem to have any comfort level at all. He, like, couldn't do anything against Tyrese Maxey. I think Nurse had a great game plan for Brunson where, Brunson likes, getting the guy on his back, doing the Trae Young thing. Well, Tyrese Maxey was that guy, and Tyrese Maxey's like, all right, well, now I'm just going to block his shot from behind every time. And it just seemed like Brunson wasn't comfortable, but also if you just project forward, it's like, well, they surely cannot play that poorly again in half-court offense. So you have to project, I think, that the Knicks will play better and that Embiid isn't going to be the force that he was for the first quarter and a half. But I mean, how do you see this series going forward?
I see the game two at a minimum and maybe game five as very, you know, very likely no contest from the Sixers. Like, I just don't understand how you can compete with this schedule and the state of your most important player in terms of physical, you know, physical fitness. And yeah, I think the Knicks are gonna be able to, you know, that I guess really what I'm saying is I agree with you that they were relatively lucky to win that game, but that's fine. And the fact that they are the better team and now they have you know, the opportunity to really put some serious pressure on the Sixers is huge, because taking a 2-0 lead into Philadelphia and getting one of game three or game four, probably game four, could potentially end this series in five. And yeah, I would be more surprised with Embiid finishing this series with a exclamation point in seven. That would surprise me more than him not playing a game seven because he's hurt, right? Like, I think the probability distribution of him not finishing the series is higher than him finishing the series in a state where he is the deciding factor.
Yeah, I think to me, the biggest takeaway from game one as to how the rest of the series will unfold, because so many things are fluky. Like, you had MVP Joel Embiid for a half, and then you had kind of very incapacitated Joel Embiid for a half. You had Jalen Brunson going 8 of 26. You had Hart and McBride lighting it up from three. You had an awesome Tyrese Maxey game. Just a lot of weird elements that I'm not sure are going to completely carry over. What I do think is going to carry over is that I just think the Knicks are going to destroy them with offensive rebounding. Mm-hmm. And they got 52% of offensive rebounds in game one. That's insane. They're getting more than half of their misses. Yeah. They're probably not going to replicate that, but I think they're going to dominate them there throughout the series. And then they destroyed them in transition. And so despite having a, I think it was a 76 offensive rating on first shots, which is insanely bad, but they still had an efficient offensive game overall just because of the offensive rebounds. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing with the Sixers team, where on paper it kind of looks okay because, you know, Lowry had a really good game. Batum's been playing well lately. Oubre has been more than they've expected. Maxey is great. Embiid is obviously great. But the Sixers don't play with force. Like, you don't feel these guys athletically if it's not Embiid being absolutely dominant or Tyrese in transition. Like, and even Tyrese, like, he's skinny. Like, he's not a physical, like, he beats you with speed and finesse. Whereas these guys like Josh Hart and Anunoby, and even like Brunson, who is just like a ball of, he just bundles into guys. Juice McBride as well. Like, these guys, you just feel them on every, and Mitchell Robinson, Hartenstein, these guys, they just crash the glass. They can get out in transition when they're allowed to. And I think just physically that you're just going to feel that every game in a way where I just don't think the Sixers are going to win this series unless Embiid gets to at least like 90% of the guy that he was in the first quarter of game one.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And if you point to the box score and you're like, well, yeah, McBride, yeah, I dare you to make five threes again. Josh Hart, yeah, make four threes again. You know who's not making four threes again? Kyle Lowry. This was as good a game as you were ever getting from Kyle Lowry, and you had a chance to steal. And if you did, then we were going to be sitting here like, wow, what do we do? More Knicks? You ready? Let's go, Hornets. Like, that was the conversation we were going to be having. And instead, I'm like, yeah, Knicks get this done in five, probably. And maybe my confidence is misplaced, but I feel like a lot of things went right for the 76ers. Tobias Harris not being a factor is notable. Tyrese Maxey having his best game that you could possibly draw up on paper is notable. Joel Embiid getting to the free throw line for 12 opportunities was notable. Like, I felt like the whistle was a little favorable, Sixers. So, you know, I ultimately, like, the Knicks kind of repeating this with just sort of an average performance and just having a clean kill in game two, I think is likely.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel like Embiid is just going to last at full health throughout this series, with the fact that he's getting re-injured in like 50% of his games that he's returned in. But I do think, last thing I'll say on this before we go to the West, is that I think that this is the type of series, because of how extraordinarily variable Embiid is with his health, where this is the type of series for tails. Like, if the Sixers, if they go down 3-0, they're in better position than most teams down 3-0 because Embiid just could get healthy for four games. If they're down 2-0, I think that's going to be priced in a way that doesn't reflect the upside of Embiid just being healthy. And then by the same token, if the Sixers were to miraculously go up 3-1, I think the Knicks would be more live than your typical team down 3-1 in that spot just because of the downside risk on Embiid, which seems to be manifesting game to game. But all in all, I don't think there's really a bet to be made at current market price. But this is a market also to just watch live because you'll be able to tell pretty quickly in game two whether Embiid has it or not. And you can tell very quickly in game one that he did have it and then he lost it. And if he doesn't have it to start game two, that is big problems for Philadelphia. And that's when you start to think like, all right, only one day between games, maybe the Knicks can really blow them out here.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. That.
Yeah.
With when that aspect is not pressed.
Yep. No, certainly massive variance game to game and within the series with this one. All right. The NFL draft kicks off Thursday and we have you covered with our mock drafts, positional rankings, player interviews and news updates around the league. Go to NBCSports.com/NFL draft today for insight leading into round one and check back throughout the draft for analysis of every pick.
150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And they're into the stretch. Oh, my goodness.
This is place to be.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
For the world's greatest athletes,
this is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again! Gold for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen
an Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics, this summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
All right, Clippers-Mavs in the West. Game two, Tuesday night. What did you make of game one of this
one? Do we have to talk about this one?
I don't watch a ton of this one.
So Mavs sweep's not happening. That is a loss. Mavs being some sort of super team seems maybe a little bit optimistic considering what we saw today. This was a weird one because first of all, weird things happen when the key player for the other team is expected to play and ultimately does not. We know this. Like the redistribution of usage for the team that is replacing that player is an unknown, other than the players who are like expecting it. And those guys stepping up and performing to the level that they did, particularly in this spot in the absence of Kawhi, was a surprise. But they were incredible. And this was not really a contest, as far as I could tell you. Like the first quarter, it felt like the Mavericks were just like, it didn't really have a plan. Didn't, you know, they were bought into the idea that this was going to be relatively straightforward thing for them, and they ultimately dig themselves into a 12-point hole in the first quarter. And we've seen the Mavericks come back from 12-point holes many times, and you look at the box score after first quarter and it was like, okay, Zubac 5 or 6, yeah, he'll keep making the, well, yeah, he did, but like ultimately, like some of the issues that the Mavericks had, I thought, were not really addressed by coaching. And then the second quarter was just an absolute bizarre performance. 8 points, like the offense having no vision, no rhythm, no fluidity was completely surprising because that is ultimately how this team is built. And we've seen the Mavericks perform at this looked like practice squad type of performance relative to what we've seen from them down the stretch. And it was very, very tough to kind of synthesize, well, is this just who they are? And we were rope-a-doped because they were playing lousy opponents. And I'm kind of thinking that there may be a small angle there where I need to get off some Mavericks here. Mavericks, the series price has not moved even commensurately to the fact that the Clippers won a game without Kawhi, and presumably he will come back and they will be, you know, kind of meaningful favorites in game 5 and 7 if this goes 7. And so now I'm staring at this price and I'm just like just trying to do the math. I can't get here. And I'm on the other side of, you know, existing bets. So, yeah, I feel like hope in the Mavs might be a little might have been a little bit misplaced. And I'm not sure that ultimately this is as good a matchup as I had originally drawn up on paper.
Okay. I think we're pretty far apart on this one, so I'm not worried about the Mavs, at least with what I've seen. One, the Clippers shot 50% from three. The Mavs shot 30%. And to my eye, they were getting better shots than the Clippers. And I just cannot buy the idea that, one, a team that is starting Terrence Mann, Amir Coffey, and Ivica Zubac can have an elite offense. Like, those are just three guys who just don't give you enough spacing. And I get that Harden and George are really good, but they shouldn't be good enough against this Dallas defense, which was great down the stretch, to be able to, you know, put up the type of performance that they did, at least in the first half. Secondly, I just, like, we've seen enough of Luka going up against Zubac and going up against, I mean, Harden, who wasn't exploited enough today. Like, I just don't buy the idea that Dallas's offense isn't going to be awesome in this series. And so I think this Dallas team, and this is, you know, somewhat just unfounded, but they just screw around. They play with their food. When they beat the Suns 2 years ago, they lost games in that series by 20 and 30, and then they won games 6 and 7 by a combined 60 points. Like, this team just weirdly runs hot and cold. I think that they just no-showed in the first half. They weren't really ready. And then by that point, it was just a little bit too late. And they made a little bit of a run at the end, but they didn't get close enough. And ultimately, I think that the Mavs are still clearly the better team. The market has opened them 2.5-point favorites against the Clippers for the next game. Now, the concern would be simply that they dropped the game, and now the Clippers only have to win 3. And if Kawhi is back for game... If he's back, then the Mavs are in trouble. One, like, Kawhi's still not taking contact. Like, how much of a lock is it that Kawhi Leonard appears in this series? Like, it's a massive red flag that he's not even taking contact and going through 5-on-5. And also, like, it's been weeks since the injury. So I think there is a material chance that, I mean, he could be back for game 2, but that seems very unlikely. He could just be done for the whole series. And if the longer that this goes without Kawhi coming back, I would be pretty surprised if the Mavs don't turn this around. I just think that there is just too much track record of what this team was post-trade deadline. And there's just too many structural flaws in this Clippers team where, you know, the zigzag thing is real. I've never really entirely understood how, why or how specifically it works, but between coaching adjustments and teams that are down going with tightened rotations and just playing a little bit harder, I guess, when your back is up against the wall, that seems to matter. And I would say that, you know, this team, particularly this Mavs team with their history, I think they will show up in game 2. And I think that, you know, I still think that the Mavs are, I still think this is a coin flip series.
Okay. I'm not disagreeing that it's a coin flip series. I'm just trying to synthesize like what this win meant, because a win without Kawhi, I think, was pretty important. The team defense from the Clippers, you can cut both ways. You can watch the tape and you can say, man, that Clippers team defense was incredible. But you can also watch that tape and be like, what in the world were the Mavericks thinking? Like, what were they doing? Like, how do you only get outside, you know, how Kyrie Irving was perfectly fine in this game. He ended up with 31 points, like, you know, 39 minutes and 31 points. He was efficient from the field. It took a way, way long time to get him involved in the offense, it felt like. Like, I just didn't understand the vision, and I'm a little nervous about just in general, like, if I missed something in terms of how they match up.
Tell you something, Drew, a quick little story. 2010 AFL Grand Final, my beloved Collingwood Magpies were decent favourites going in against St Kilda, and they drew the Grand Final. And in the AFL, previously, they changed the rule after this, but when there was a draw, you would replay the Grand Final the following week. So I was going in on the train to see the replay grand final. My Collingwood Magpies who hadn't won the premiership in 20 years. And normally I'm very pessimistic about my teams, my positions. I just naturally gravitate towards thinking things are going to go south. But I just remember being on the train thinking like, all right, well, all of our best players played poorly. Dane Swan did nothing in the draw. Alan Dydak, Scott Pendlebury, Travis Cloak did nothing. All of these guys were down and we still got a draw. And everyone is just going to have to play at a certain raise level and we're going to win this game. And they did win by 50-odd points. And I think with the Mavs, now, they didn't get a draw, but everything went badly for them in this game. Mm-hmm. Like all of these guys, like Gafford was 1 for 4. He scored 3 points in 14 minutes. He did absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. Luka was terrible. And I know he ended up +3, but like what the parts of the game that I saw, like
he wasn't there at all.
Why is Maxi Kleber playing 27 minutes? Like that just makes no sense whatsoever, given that Gafford came back from the little ankle roll. Like I just don't think that these guys are going to play this badly again. And there's so much more upside with them. And on the other hand, like I think that Harden's not going to shoot 6 of 11 from 3 consistently. Zubac isn't going to look like Wilt Chamberlain each game. Like I just think there's a lot of more downside. The main thing is the Clippers, they've shot 50% from 3. Any team shoots 50% from 3 and plays hard on defense, it's just hard to beat them in their home. Yeah.
I will just tell you this. As someone who has a bunch of Mavs in pocket, I watched this game and I was like, wow, I guess I really thought much more highly than I should have of PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford and Maxi Kleber. Like the ancillary pieces around the Mavericks are a big question mark.
Yeah, I don't know why Jason Kidd's playing 9 guys as part of his regular rotation. Like Kleber can just go, like get rid of Kleber. 10 guys, he played Josh Green 9 minutes as well. Kleber can go, the bench should just be Hardaway, Lively, and Exum. Like that's it. Like why in the second quarter of game one of the playoffs, he's playing Maxi Kleber next to Derek Lively. Like what are you doing, Jason? Like you cannot play this way. You just need 8 guys. You don't need to play Kleber. Just play Gafford and Lively as the lone bigs and it'll be fine. So I'm not worried about the Mavs yet. Even if they go down 2-0, I'm kind of low-key, not like I don't think it's over yet, but I think they will show up in game 2. A team that's going to have to show up in game 2 are the Los Angeles Lakers, who, they were up, what were they? I think they were up like 49-36 in the live money line. They were like a minus 160.
Was it an 18-point
They were up a fair bit, and they were material favorites on the money line, and then it kind of all went south before halftime. LeBron hits the buzzer beater at half to push them back up 3, but the tide had already turned, and then the avalanche came in the third quarter, and now we're back in the familiar situation of the Nuggets being -700 to win the series, Lakers +500, and it really feels like through nothing has changed from the matchup last year, D'Angelo Russell, who's fantastic down the stretch of the regular season, kind of reproving himself, perhaps, as Seth Partnow said on Twitter, that he's more of an 82-game player than a 16-game player, where it just seems like he doesn't belong on the court with these guys.
Yeah. So the larger lead was actually 12, correction, retractions. The Lakers were only up 12. But the way that they were playing in the first half, I thought was certainly enough to keep this game competitive and, absolutely enough to get +7 home. The fact that the Lakers blew this cover really hurts. This was my biggest loss of the weekend. And ultimately I would make this bet again because, and I'm about to make this bet again because I think 7.5 is too big of a number, but I will say that, the big concern here is Anthony Davis played 45 minutes. LeBron and D'Angelo Russell were both 40+. Like that is the playoff rotation minutes you were hoping to see. And ultimately all of those guys were minuses. D'Angelo Russell, weirdly, a +2 actually. So I take that back. But that must have been just some fluky stuff because he wasn't good. He wasn't good. Right. And the 1 for 9 from 3 was hugely problematic. He's not going to go 1 for 9 again. I don't think. I think ultimately it didn't feel. I was watching this through yellow and purple glasses. So bear with me, but I thought a lot of his shots looked very, very clean out of his hand. Like it was like, this is going in. And then it was just hit back rim. And it was like, oh, killing me. And, you know, there may have been a little bit of a, home court effect, because you know it is tough to go play in Denver. You brought this up last week and you were very right. Like, this is the biggest home court advantage of any home team in the playoffs currently by margin. And I think the fact that the Lakers couldn't make shots, particularly Russell, was you know, kind of ultimately swung this game in the third quarter. And I didn't see anything from the Nuggets that I was like, wow, I missed something. This is a super team. Like, they still feel very vulnerable to me. And I think, you know, but that said, like, the Lakers' pattern for winning games as the underseeded team last year was straightforward. It was, we are going to give our starters max minutes in game one in an attempt to steal home court, and then they're going to throw up the white flag in game two, throw up the white flag in game five, but we're going to defend home court in three and four, and then we're going to put this away in six. And now you can't. Like, now you need to go run these guys back again 40-plus and hope that on a quick turnaround at altitude, James and Davis can do it. I have kind of lost a little bit of kind of confidence in this being the right side here, even at 7.5, which is even bigger number than what we had an opportunity to bet last time. But I do think that there is a narrower margin between these two teams. And rewatching this game, I thought, wow, those two teams were closer than an 11-point final score. But yeah, I'm painted into a bit of a corner here.
Yeah, you know what the thing is that I noticed most with this matchup, which now we've seen a lot of, is just how kind of small and helpless Anthony Davis looks on the court against Jokic, mm-hmm. where it's just like, it's kind of it's a visual thing for one, where, I mean, Jokic has only got like an inch on him, but he's got 30 pounds on him as well. And Davis just has no chance whatsoever against Jokic. Jokic is just too smart. He's too strong. He makes you feel those extra 30 pounds and that extra 1 inch. And he just doesn't have any issue whatsoever with Anthony Davis, who, I mean, thinking back to the bubble, I thought Davis was better than LeBron in the finals in the bubble. And I came out of that playoff run thing like, is Anthony Davis just the best player in the world? Because I think he's the best defensive player and he's consistently scoring 30 plus efficiently. So maybe he's just the best basketball on earth. And now he's just like in a different tier entirely to Jokic. And like, he can't get anything against Jokic in the post with his own offense. Jokic is just too strong and just doesn't get moved. And then he can't really do that much against Jokic defensively. So, I mean, and it's like, it's Anthony Davis. Like, he should be, by now, he should be the best player on this team. He's still not. LeBron's still the better player. And I just don't know, like, if they're going to get, if D'Angelo Russell is this much of a no-show, then they're just not going to have any chance. Mm-hmm. And if they need to go more to Dinwiddie and Vincent than Russell, then those guys, it's just like a different iteration of the Dennis Schroeder show last year, and they just didn't have enough offense with that. So I think it's pretty helpless for the Lakers at the moment. And yeah, I think this market is priced appropriately, unfortunately, for you and for me as someone who's against the Nuggets in the West broadly with the futures positions. I'm not thinking like this soldier is going to take them down for me. I think I'm going to need someone to give me some help in the next round.
Yeah, we need this soldier to at least draw some blood, though.
Yes.
Like, please. Like, this can't be 4-0. If this is a Nuggets sweep, this is a problem.
Feels very 4-1-ish.
It feels very 4-1-ish. It does. And my assertion that the Lakers could win the against the spread 4-1 while losing 4-1 outright, like, okay, well, half of that prediction sounds very, very correct, and the other half does not. Because boy, oh boy, when the Nuggets, because like, this was not a good Nuggets game, right? Like, you didn't come out of this game like fearing the Nuggets. This was just everything I thought the Lakers were going to be able to do to maintain, a full four quarters of competitive basketball was not to be.
Nuggets kind of did nothing for a quarter and a half. Yeah. They're barely on the court, and they gave the Lakers that 12-point head start, and it just didn't matter. They were up double digits themselves in the blink of an eye. Yeah. So, Drew, I told you I wasn't worried about my Mavs position. I'm a little more worried about my Suns position relative to how the market has moved, where against the Wolves, they are blown out by 25. Now, it seemed like they missed, I mean, they were 9 of 28 from 3. No one could really do anything outside of Kevin Durant. Devin Booker had 0 out of 10 game for him. And Anthony Edwards was making just some ridiculous shots. Now, the disparity from three actually wasn't that significant, but just the way this game unfolded, and I do think that these two teams have such weird collections of elite talent that I would be pretty surprised if there aren't some twists and turns in this series just because of the different things that each kind of coach can stress and prioritize. But the fact that the Wolves went with Cat on KD, which has been well chronicled, as a Suns backer, I didn't like that because like, all right, KD and Nate Duncan and Danny LaRue did a really good job breaking this down on Dunked On, but it's kind of like KD with his offense. It's very much like, all right, well, he can eat, but when he eats, it's like, all right, well, he's taking a 50% mid-range shot and no one else is really getting involved and there's no like machine and there's no putting the defense in rotation. It's just KD kind of getting his and everyone else wasn't getting anything. And then the Wolves were getting out in transition and Anthony Edwards was insane. But what do you make of this series now?
Yeah, so I had Timberwolves in game one. I'm on Timberwolves in game two. I think this is... there is still very much potential for this to go longer. You know, sort of the baseline expectation was if the Timberwolves play defense well, they're going to make life hard for the Suns. And if the Timberwolves offense isn't clicking, well, at least they can out rebound them every which way you can possibly draw it up. And that was sort of the story of game one. I felt like the rebounding disadvantage for the Suns was sort of their death knell. The fact that they got three offensive rebounds while the Timberwolves got 13. They were out-rebounded 52-28. That is not a sustainable ratio, particularly if you're not going to win the three-point shooting differential. And a lot of sort of the talk about this series heading in, and we are excluded from this. We were not basing our handicap at all on the regular season, but the Suns shot lights out against the Timberwolves from three during the regular season. And they will have games in this series where they shoot lights out because they have some absolutely amazing shooters on the floor. But if they are not shooting lights out, then they are in deep trouble. And I think ultimately, if we have another game in Minnesota where the Timberwolves play defense as well as they did against the Suns and take advantage of the rebounding opportunities, then they're going to go to Phoenix with a 2-0 lead. And at that point, it's going to be time for Kevin Durant to put his cape on because they're going to need a higher level of efficiency and productivity than we even saw in a 39-minute, 31-point effort from him, which is which was impressive. It was telltale though. He had five turnovers. That is like classical Kevin Durant. And I think ultimately the Timberwolves in particular take such phenomenal advantage of turnovers in transition. And the Suns, while they do play, good disciplined transition defense, if you're up against guys who can run like Anthony Edwards, then you're in deep trouble. And so ultimately I think the Timberwolves are going to be able to replicate the success in game two, and then it's going to come down to Suns either defending home court in three and four or conceding and then this being a shorter series.
Yeah, we'll go deeper into this one tomorrow, but the one thing I just want to bring up quickly is Kevin Durant in the playoffs. He's a made man in the playoffs because of what he did, not just winning the two finals MVPs, but more for me, what he did against the Bucks in that series when he was on Brooklyn, where he did put on his Superman cape and he was majestic. But the past 2 years, like, he got punked by Jason Tatum, who everyone makes jokes about. Well, Jason Tatum absolutely cooked Kevin Durant for four games in a sweep where Kevin Durant shot 38.6% from the field. And then Durant was terrible against Denver. Like, you just did not feel him at all last season. That was Devin Booker's series.
He played Durant in that series, right?
Yeah, well, he shot 22% from three in that series. He had four turnovers a game to five assists per game, shot 45% from the field. He's the average 29.5 a game just because he took a million shots. But, I mean, it hasn't been a great couple of years in the playoffs for Kevin Durant. If they lose the series 4-1 or something, then, I mean, viewing Kevin Durant as a top 7-8 player, if that's not already kind of trending out the door, then I think it will be out the door entirely. But we'll talk about that one more tomorrow. Drew, next stop on the IndyCar series is Barber Motorsports Park in Alabama. The green flag waves at 1:30 p.m. Eastern, only on NBC and Peacock. Your kind of game.
You don't have to tell me.
Yeah, this is your world now, my friends.
Scott McLaughlin.
150 years, the Kentucky Derby's been an icon of racing and luxury. I'm gonna shine my way. The first Saturday in May, the world turns its attention here.
They're off in the Kentucky Derby. And they're into the stretch. Oh, my goodness.
This is the place to be.
The 150th Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 4th, on NBC and Peacock.
For the world's greatest athletes.
This is the showdown we've been waiting for.
There is nothing like competing on the world's biggest stage.
It's a world record again! Goal for the United States! Unbelievable!
And when that stage is Paris, anything can happen.
I have never seen anything like this.
How about that?
An Olympics unlike any other.
What a performance!
The Paris Olympics. This summer on NBC and streaming on Peacock.
There you go. All right. Well, my world is Celtics Heat, which we can spend 28 seconds on. I don't know really what to say about this, although you very rarely see a team being a 15.5-point favorite in a playoff game.
Yeah.
I can't remember if that has happened, but this is as big of a mismatch as you can imagine. There will be no Leicester City winning the Premier League title type of fairy tale shot here, I would have thought. Any words, sentences about Celtics Heat?
I thought the Heat did exactly the right plan. Like, their plan was, I think, sound. And I almost want to give their coaching and their scouting credit. Like, what they asked the Celtics to do, I think, was the right questions. The problem is the Celtics answered those questions with an emphatic, we can do that. Celtics finishing this in four feels right. The Jimmy Butler absence, I don't think matters. It was going to go relatively quickly in favor of the Celtics with or without him. It's sad for us as basketball fans that we don't have a more entertaining game in the 1-8 series, you know, more entertaining series in the 1-8 matchup. But there's no magic for the Heat here. They played hard. I thought they played well, honestly, in what was a very lopsided defeat. So I don't ultimately think there's much hopefulness here if you are a Heat fan or supporter.
Yes. No, this one seems like a wrap, and the Celtics just need to get through it with health. All right. Their opponents, assuming they do get through, which I'm going to assume they do, the Celtics, will be the Magic, or more likely, the Cleveland Cavaliers, who are now -400 favorites to win the series. The Magic +310. The Cavs closed -200 or so to win the series. Before game one, Cavs 5.5-point favorites in game two. The total is a lowly 202.5. This one, you can go back and forth on how instructive a game one is. I didn't think that game one of Mavs Clippers was particularly instructive. I did think it was for Lakers Nuggets, and I did think it was for Magic Cavs, because it brought home two things that I thought coming into the series, which was one, Cleveland's slide, alleged slide, was just massively overrated because Donovan Mitchell played 8 total games after February 28th. So it's like, all right, well, he's the best. He's twice as good as any other player on the team, and he was out forever, and the team lost a lot of games. Great. That's not really instructive to me. All that matters is he healthy? And when he had that, when he picked Joe Ingles, pick 6 in the first quarter, I want to say, and had like the hammer dunk, it's like, he's fine. And he looked great. And he was 11 of 21, scored 30 points, 3 of 8 from 3. So he looked great. But the main thing is, Drew, I just don't think the Magic can score in this series.
Yeah, the Magic aren't very good, Jay.
No, they're not.
I'm not sure if you bet much magic. No, I'm not sure if you had a big old Betsy that you were sweating on the Magic to win the Southeast, and you watched a lot of Magic basketball down the stretch, but this is a bad offense. They started Jonathan Isaac, who is one of the best defenders in the NBA, but it does not matter. There are still huge, huge structural flaws with the way they want to run offense. They need, they just need miracle performances from some of the kind of supporting pieces, the Cole Anthony's of the world, if they're going to even compete with the Cavs, and if Donovan Mitchell is healthy, and that is the key. We talked about it when we reviewed the series. Donovan Mitchell is the best player in the series, and it's not close. I am my biggest upside here of any result is under 5.5 games. I bet at +180 because I think the Cavs can get this done 4-0, 4-1. Because I am very, very unconvinced that the Magic are going to be able to find anything noteworthy in terms of, just fluid offense. The fact that Paolo Banchero had the ball in his hand so frequently and was just a turnover machine in this contest is a huge problem for the Magic. Jalen Suggs really had no ability to get going from three. He was 1 of 7. Gary Harris and Jalen Suggs are your two guards. Okay. If you have a team with, if you're starting Isaac, Banchero, and Wagner, you need shooting around those players. And if Gary Harris goes 0-5 and Jalen Suggs goes 1-7, like honestly, the fact that you only lost by 14 is probably flattering. And I think ultimately the Cavs had some moments in this game where they let the Magic kind of at least sniff competitiveness, which is sort of, I don't want to say it's quintessential Cavs, but it feels like it's a little bit in their DNA that they let teams kind of hang around, and they could lose a game that way, but I don't think they can lose a series that way.
Yeah, I agree. I just think that they just have nothing to press on offense. There's no advantage to leverage. Mm-hmm. There's no path to generating good shots. And then on the other end, like Donovan Mitchell, who I think has weirdly become kind of overrated, I guess. Underrated, I guess, because of how the Knicks series went last year and how the Jazz flamed off in the playoffs repeatedly. Like, Mitchell has become an offensive kind of supernova. He was incredible this season when he was healthy. And I think that as good as the Magic's defense is, just having Donovan Mitchell out there on the floor gives your offense a certain raised floor. And it's a floor that Orlando themselves on offense just cannot get to. Mm-hmm. And I think Franz Wagner is magnificent, but the fact that he just cannot shoot threes this year is a massive problem. Paolo Banchero, I think, is one of the most overrated players in the league, and I think he will get to where people think he is at the moment. I think he will get there at some point because he's got all the tools, but like, he is not a source of incredible offense at the moment, and he doesn't really have, I think... I was messaging with a friend who, we both bet the Cavs, and my friend was complaining about why isn't JB Bickerstaff, why isn't he matching up Mobley's minutes with Banchero? To which I replied, like, I just don't think it matters. I just don't think Paolo's good enough where you need to really care about matching up minutes with someone. Like, put George Niang on him. Like, is he really going to get absolutely cooked? Like, I don't think so. Like, he's just going to kind of get to his mid-ranger and fade away. And he's a good passer. And he's a very good player, but he's not a superstar or close. And I just don't think they're going to be able to score against the Cavs, who some teams are going to be able to punish the Cavs for the too big allotment, but this Magic team isn't going to be able to do it, I don't think.
Yeah. You know who had the most impressive, the only guy from the Magic who I was like, oh, that guy's a pulse? It was Mo Wagner.
He was kind of scary.
That's not a good sign, though. No, it's not a good sign.
No, I think this is, the Cavs are a little fraudulent as well, but this kind of, it just feels like 4-1 to me at the moment. And I think the Cavs should roll, and then they'll get swept by the Celtics. All right, don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wages. Thanks to those watching on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. If you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. Also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to amazon.com/NBCSports. From Jake Croucher and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you tomorrow.